Southern leaders are claiming that states had the sovereign right to leave the Union if the federal government violated their rights, particularly regarding slavery. Here's a fun fact about the Constitution. There is no right to leave for any reason you want. Just for the record, the Constitution and its federal system never claimed that states didn't have the right to self-govern. In fact, it very explicitly was like, hey, here's the 10th Amendment. You have the right to govern. And somebody's like, yeah, but I want slaves. It's like, no, federal.
Hello and welcome to the Buck Starts Here, the podcast that usually digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. But today we've got something a little bit different planned. I am Kyle, the Emilio to Eric's Charlie Sheen, and today we're taking a break from the presidential amazing. Dead zone.
That was amazing. I'm sorry, that was amazing.
We're taking a break from the presidential dead zone to talk about something more than a little misunderstood, and the idea of states' rights.
Yeah.
Yeah, set the stage
I'm
for us.
I'm very excited about this one.
So how did this kind of came about? Because of some discussions we were having offline about just the misunderstanding of states' rights in general. So do we want to start with the question of like, do they exist? What they are? Or how do you want to?
Yeah, exactly. Because like states' rights. See, it's funny. What we do on the show, as everybody knows, we're very anti modern politics, and I think it's funny that actually sometimes leads us to want to clarify modern political, I'm going to say modern political things, but we have this repetitive theme that has popped up over and over again is this terms of states' rights. When we talk about nullification and talking about John C. Calhoun and talking about all these Andrew Jackson, all these different people who took these radical positions that changed the course of U.S. history over this idea of states' rights.
Right.
And what I found kind of funny is, when Kyle and I talk about this, and, we talk to other people, we hear stories, is that that idea of states' rights has kind of always stuck around. Mm-hmm. Kyle and I were like, maybe it'd be fun to talk about where did states' rights come from? Where did this idea of states' rights come from? And what makes it very funny is that it came from the Constitution.
Yeah, kind of.
It's the 10th Amendment.
But the 10th Amendment doesn't actually give the state any rights.
Yep.
Right?
100%.
Right.
But that idea of where it sits. So the states' rights really falls, into four categories, right? All right. So the first category, the first category is something called compact theory. Then you have states' rights is really this discourse involving the economic and, social structure of a state. And their ability to do it. This idea of what we call the nullification concept. Mm-hmm. And then finally, in the most important part, is the application of states' rights, which for the period we're discussing is slavery. And these things all kind of come together. And they each have their own, and we're going to go through these kind of four pillars and talk about where do you track the term state rights within that pillar.
Mm-hmm.
As the U.S. Constitution, the 18th century is getting structured, there's this idea of this struggle between federalism and anti-federalism. And there's this idea that, anti-federalism is anti-national government. It's not. There are really three types of ways we see government structured in the world. I'm sure there's more and there's nuances to each one, but we see three very broad brushes.
Please don't crap on communism again. I cannot handle another.
Yes, you can.
Comment discussion.
Cool, communism works. No, it doesn't. It just doesn't work. I don't know what you want from me. It doesn't work. So these three broad systems that we have of governments are centralized governments, which is like France. That is when you have the capital of the nation.
Which French government?
The modern French government. So centralized. Centralized is also, at this time in history, it's like a monarch. Everything reigns from the capital, from the castle, from one direction. It's the national government, the provisional government, and the local government, all in one order. The other type is called a confederate, or confederacy. No, a confederacy doesn't only refer to the South during the Civil War. They only lasted for 4 years, so they don't get a form of government named after them.
Could we consider the EU as a form of confederacy?
It's a form of confederacy, yes, absolutely. And a confederacy basically means you have a national, or in the case of the EU, an international governing body, but then the run right below it, in the case of like the United States, it would be each state would then have the ability to supersede directions from the national government. The EU has that, where mm-hmm. states get to do as they please. They can broadly fall under the, you know, the international, you know, governing body that is the EU and get all the advantages of being part of the EU. But they don't have to. It's not like the EU can remove a president.
Is that why the EU never really took off? Because they gave too much power to the individual countries? I guess it's hard to get them to even cede that power to...
I mean, if you want me to be overly economist, I'm going to quote the... I think it was the finance minister of the EU, or one of the guys who was part of the structure, the architecture of the EU, said, like, there is no such thing as fiscal unity without... there's no such thing as monetary unity without fiscal unity. As long mm-hmm. as everybody has their own bank account, can do what they want, it won't work. Money drives policy, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then we have the federal style of government. In the United States, we use the term federal government and national government interchangeably, to the point where we don't even use the term national government anymore. We just say the federal government.
Yeah.
Federal government is above, but everything the federal government does not have explicit permission for then falls to the states. And then states can independently manage themselves. And then the states are above the local government. So that's why you have different laws in every state. Now, the 10th Amendment is actually very powerful because this right of enumeration of states also has this ability where states recognize other states' authorities. So your driver license works in another state.
Right.
Without the 10th Amendment, it wouldn't work. And without the Confederacy, or if it wasn't a Confederacy, it wouldn't work at all. Just mm-hmm. like laws don't apply in France, it's the same as they do in right. Greece. Even though
to go from France to Germany, you need a passport still, even if they are members of the same organization.
Yeah, then they have what's called the Schengen system.
They started to make something to allow travel a little bit
yeah,
more.
It's called I'm probably going to pronounce it, but I believe it's called the Schengen system.
Yeah, okay.
How does states' rights fit in there? Well, it's defining where does the state fit relative to the federal government. Now, we had the Articles of Confederation, and the Articles of Confederation, which lasted a lot longer than the Confederacy, and it's funny that the Confederacy gets thought of as the example of a Confederacy in the United States. Even
I know,
though
right? We had a Confederacy to start with.
Yeah, we started with the Confederacy. Right. Tecumseh oversaw a confederacy of native tribes
right.
that lasted longer than the confederacy. My underwear I'm wearing is probably three times as old as confederacy lasted. I don't know why we keep trying to remember this organization. It was horrible. It failed horribly.
Was Grand Columbia a confederacy?
That was very weird. Probably doesn't fit well. It was a federalized system, but I don't know if it had the ability to rule such a diaspora of different groups. That's an interesting question there. Also, their constitution is different. What ends up happening, so it's the struggle of, and remember, the United States is one of the first federal systems. The Dutch had a federation, but it's often, and what's interesting, so we don't usually talk about the United States as being a federation, right? We are a federation of states, but it's not the same as in how you would see broad autonomy that is different from state to state. So a federation, a lot of times the autonomy, and Russia is an example of a federation, where there's certain autonomy standards that are given different to different areas. Where the United mm-hmm. States, all states have the same amount of autonomy. There's no special privilege to states. What's interesting, most people may not know this, is that there's actually variation in municipal autonomy throughout the country. So if you're in Massachusetts, there's no such thing as a special city charter. So a charter is a city's constitution. Every charter is the same from the state. But if you go to New York, New York City has what's called a special city charter, so New York can levy its own taxes. Now, states have the right to levy taxes, and they have ways to levy taxes, you know, plus or minus the way, in different manners. But the federal government maintains supreme jurisdiction. It is the federal government law is equal law across the entire land, mm-hmm. No matter what a state wants to do. This is where states' rights discussion begins to percolate. And where it percolates, ironically, it percolates from the man who wrote the oldest still in use constitution in the United States, in the world, John Adams.
Okay.
So what ends up happening is, and this is where we end up encountering compact theory. And I think compact theory is a very important discussion here.
Can you explain compact theory? Because I don't think I've heard that before.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of a esoteric thing of political philosophy. But basically what compact theory held, that the constitution was a contract between states, not between the people and the national government. Therefore, the states were the ultimate arbiters of constitutional meaning.
Oh.
Compact theory is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense because the states are the ones that have to abide and honor it. Like, it makes sense that they'd be agreeing amongst themselves that this is how we're going to rule ourselves.
Yeah. So what it was basically saying is the constitutions exist between state. The Constitution describes relationship between states and the federal government,
mm-hmm.
not between the state. Then gets to decide how it wants to handle people, you know, issues right. with people, and the people have no real authority to appeal through to the federal government because they don't have a contract with the federal government. It's an interesting view on social contracts, but this really didn't become an issue until 1798. And we have this thing called the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. And it was a response to the Alien Sedition Act by John Adams. And it basically asserted that states could declare federal laws unconstitutional. And this is what's considered the foundational text for later state right advocates, is that from now on, from this point forward in the United States, state right activists are following this idea of the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions.
It's interesting that because this is before Supreme Court has been established, right? There's no judicial review necessarily at this point, or do we have that?
We have the Supreme Court now. Okay, review hasn't been fully fleshed out. Ironically, we'll also see that at the end of Adams's presidency with Marlborough versus Madison. But no, Supreme Court exists. But the Supreme Court's there to adjudicate federal interpretations. These early state right advocates aren't disputing the federal government has the ability to manage the federal government and that judicial review has the ability to overturn federal rulings. They're arguing that even if they overturned a state ruling, that has nothing to do with how they manage people. At the end of the day, government's here. That's what the governments are trying to do. They're trying to manage people. So as we advance further in time, we really start talking about states' rights evolving into this economic and social underpinnings. And this idea that state rights have something to do with how you position yourself in society, and then again, how the economy is structured. And this becomes exceptionally pronounced as we move through the early 1800s and industrialization starts to take hold, because it creates a dual economy. It creates a dual economy that is inherently going to rip itself apart.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is where we move to what the Civil War is about, which was about slavery. State rights is simply an argument slaveholders were using to keep slaves. It was not about states' rights.
They're just trying to say the federal government has no right to say whether or not I can own slaves. That's up to us as a state to decide.
Yes. Exactly. So what ended up happening is the North industrialized very quickly, right? You know, the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution was in Lowell, Massachusetts.
You don't rely on forced labor. It's amazing what you can do.
Right? And not only are you not relying on forced labor, but the thing you're producing, the capital you're using, capitalism, is way more productive.
Yeah.
Just way, way, way more productive. Something interesting, in 1990, about 25% of the U.S. economy was manufacturing. About 25% of people worked in manufacturing, give or take. Mm-hmm. By the time we get to the 2000s, it's like 15-ish%, but by 20 to 15%. Now, manufacturing is 15% of the population, 15% of the GDP, but it's only 8% of the population because machines have gotten better. And the North rapidly industrialized and created a very, and I'm going to sound like the most biased Northerner. And guess what? I'm a complete biased Northerner. I'm just telling you honestly. Yeah,
you're on the winning team. You get to do it.
Team that won the Civil War and team that guy, like our guy, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, especially John Adams, was like, hey, this is messed up. Let's not own people. Yeah, I'm fine taking the victory lap on that. I think, if people can build statues to failed traitors from the South, I think I'm okay with being like, oh, I like my guy who liked the Constitution and the rule of law. Oh, but he was kind of cantankerous. Like, okay, cool. But he was cantankerous because the other side was trying to own people.
He ate a lot of sweets.
Fine. Yeah. Like, oh, he wants to just hang out on his farm. Yeah, he did his own farm work. So as this idea of economic duality became more real in the United States, it started to cause what I can best describe as a crisis in the South, where the South saw that, oh no, like we're becoming economically weaker. We're heavy export driven, but we're economically weaker. In fact, the cotton gin, which Eli Whitney originally made the cotton gin because he thought it would end slavery and it made it more prolific.
Right.
Because when you inject capital into something, people become more productive, which means the margins become expanded, or in this case, the margins are able to better fight against the natural cost could increase. There's a lot of economists, especially labor economics, who will argue that slavery always leads to economic failure. It's just how long does it take?
Is that just like a more exacerbated version of like the service, the way that service industry cannot keep pace with inflation?
Yeah, it's kind of like Dutch disease, which is like what ends up happening. You have like this big economic growth in one industry. That industry, everybody works for that one industry, say it's oil, and you create two industries where you have everybody working for oil making a ton of money, and then they are, you know, they want to buy, then there's a bunch of demand for service industries like, you know, restaurants and stuff like that, not like financial services, but like literal service industries, and all this money's being created, and, you know, this wealth is gaining, and wealth pushes up the price levels, but those price levels of the workers don't end up competing there. So like Dutch disease, which is named after the Dutch when it happened, like, you can fight that by having like sovereign wealth funds or investing in other industries that can balance out wages. What you don't want to have is that runaway effect where you end up economically scaling some industry, especially like a resource extraction industry that's going to eventually collapse.
Right.
You kind of siphon that away and put the money aside. Hello, Norway. Hello, Dakotas. I know West Virginia would be – get back. It's like West Virginia's kind of solved it, but was originally a resource-cursed state. I mean, the wealthiest – city in America for like a decade was Sisterville in West Virginia because of the oil industry, and obviously that didn't stick. So the slaveholders in the South start using the states' rights argument because they are now realizing that they become scared that Northerners are going to use their economic influence to basically rid themselves of slaves. To me, I'm like, that is there it is. There's your argument. It was never about this, you know, theoretical, philosophical states' rights issue about where does it fall relatively. No, if the only reason you're
just a way to try to protect yourself,
right? And it's like, oh, the people who aren't using people aren't owning people to and creating more money. Yeah, maybe those are the people we should base our economy on.
Maybe those are the ones we should listen to. They seem to have something figured out.
I just don't like the way they sound. they talk weird. They're always went to Harvard. I don't even know what that is. Like, so.
They're always telling me about it too. I don't know why. Very loud.
And so the Southerners come up with this. Just go a little back. So, like, as we progress to the 19th century, especially to the mid 19th century, you know, the preservation of slavery really becomes an underpinning issue of the economic and social discussion around states' rights. Southern states used the doctrine of states' rights to argue the federal government had no authority to regulate or abolish slavery within their borders. And this then transitioned into this argument that slaveholders made within the states about economic autonomy. And Southern states argued that federal tariffs, international and internal improvement programs disproportionately benefited Northern states, and that states' rights became a vehicle to oppose economic policy that Southerners viewed as hostile to their agrarian economy. I find it very funny when they're like, equally applied tariffs hurt us more. It's like, what? Equally applied tariffs hurt you more? Well, because your system's garbage.
Right.
Your system's garbage. I'm sorry, your system's garbage. And they're like, yeah, but you're going to like the people who are bringing in more money. It's like, yes. What is that? Why is that? It's like they probably thought they were taking crazy pills. Yes, we're favoring the more economically productive people who don't rely on this incredibly, even the founding fathers, this incredibly immoral thing. They're making more money. They are expanding faster. They're hiring more people. Everybody's becoming, you know, wealthier. Oh my God.
Including the people doing the work.
Yes. Are they horrific work standards? Right. Of course they are. Are they?
But you know what? They're a lot better than they were 100 years ago.
Yes. And they're able to own their own labor, which is a hallmark of capitalism, by the way. That's like the only, actually, you always own your own labor. Labor is always privately owned, but capitalism is the only one where you can exchange that labor for your own goods to make decisions. So they fit in. What they fear is that, you know, many Southerners believe that federal power could become a tool for the Northern majorities to impose their values on them, and that those values would be enforced by how the economic system the South claimed benefited them.
If only it wasn't about slavery, they'd have a much better argument.
Yeah, if only the argument wasn't like, I don't like the people who are better at doing this than me. It's like, okay, we'll be better at it. Yeah, but I want to sing and play my violin.
We need to feed everybody in the country. Like, this is an important industry to protect. Maybe we should look at it that way, in that angle.
Yeah, and it becomes, you know, so the southern states, they really start pushing this at the time. And this leads up to what's called the nullification crisis of 1832 to 1833, which we discussed, when South Carolina attempted to nullify a federal tariff. And it really did test the limits of states' rights. And this was led by John C. Calhoun, that we, you know, I mentioned in the intro. And I'm going to just be honest. He articulated a very sophisticated defense of nullification. We covered it in the episode, but basically arguing that states could veto unconstitutional federal laws. In the crux of his argument, and this is an interesting argument. There's many parts to it, but what I thought was interesting. His argument revolved around how do you define a constitutionality? And of course, a Federalist is going to say, that thing called the Supreme Court in Article 3, the thing that the Founding Fathers explicit. Oh, by the way, the Founding Fathers are still alive. Do you want to go? Ask them if you want. Right. J. Tom Rowe's still floating around. John Quincy Adams is, he's in Congress. I don't think he's in Congress at this time, but like, it's like, you can just go ask that dude. He was with his dad when they wrote all of it. And so John C. Calhoun was like, basically argued that no, if you think states, and this is a good argument, not that I agree with it, but it's a solid rationale. He's like, no. Unconstitutionality between federal operations, what the federal government's doing, absolutely does the Supreme Court hold there. But once it passes on to the state, who gets to decide that? And everybody's like, the constitutions. But if you're a states' right activist and you are a states' right advocate, I should say, you already, as principle, reject the idea that the federal government has the ability to administer states.
Right. This is something that should have been agreed to like a long time ago.
Oh, it was. They just ignored it.
Okay.
And how bad was it? Andrew Jackson, so clearly somebody who was very pro-slavery, he actually outright rejected it and went and very affirmatively asserted the supremacy of federal law. And he did this through the compromise tariff, which did help de-escalate the situation. But as I mentioned, you know, as we finished up the Polk episode, that I do think that specific crisis right there was one of the seeds that went into play for the Civil War, because it was like, now there's no other recourse. Isn't this constitutional recourse. It's only going to be militarily. And we start to see, obviously we start to see it expressed in kind of like the final pillar, right? Is we start to see this expressed through expansion and secession for the Union. Slavery expansion and then obviously secession from the slavery issue. So as states' rights is firmly rejected over and over and over and over again, there is actually never a point where states' rights is really seen as correct. I just want to be clear with that. There's actually never a point where people are like, oh, no, there are states' rights. States' rights outside of the 10th Amendment.
Specifically assigned to them. They just... Yeah. The only thing that... maybe we should pull the text of that up and look at it again, but... Basically, all that is saying is that we have anything that the Constitution hasn't weighed in on, the state has a chance to weigh on it if they so desire, right?
Exactly. So, we'll read. It's only one sentence.
So, all the rights belong to all the amendments. We learned that lesson too. But all the rights are basically things that we've chosen to trade in as citizens for freedoms, right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's how, you know, that's a very like John
simplistic way of looking at it. But yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the way that Ninth Amendment's written.
Yeah. So the Ninth Amendment is the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other retained rights by the people. So it means strict interpretation of how you limit rights of the people. Ninth Amendment. And then the next one, they were like, hey, by the way, the powers, and this is an exact quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. Mm-hmm. Which is basically the Ninth Amendment is saying, hey, if the Constitution hasn't weighed in on it, both affirmatively or negatively, the states can make a decision. So the minute the federal government makes a decision, it now applies to the states. That's basically what it's saying.
Right.
And so it's a very weak argument constitutionally. Yeah. The only person to ever come close to a good argument was John C. Calhoun. And his argument is, you know, really it's based on a predetermined solution. It's determinism is what it's called. Like, you know, some lawyer could correct me wrong, but determinism is usually like trying to look at a law as it's making the assumptions on how the people wrote it, as opposed to how it's applied, which is Just back to the point that you could ask somebody. There were people
I
around.
I know, yeah. That's the, that's...
like, yeah, okay. So the nullification crisis occurred in 1833. James Madison was still alive.
Yeah, thank you.
The guy who wrote the
Constitution. Yes.
You could have went up to him and said, hey, Jimmy, I'm curious about your thoughts. And Jimmy would be like, what are you talking about? I wrote those.
What do you think these guys meant when they wrote this? What do you think you meant when you wrote this? Yeah.
I still think being the Attorney General to James Madison must have just been awkward.
That's still my favorite show we've done.
So how do I interpret this law? This is how I interpret this law. No, incorrect. Yeah, but the statute, I'm the statute. I wrote it. It was a committee of five. I ran the committee of five. You jerk. Unless you're John Adams, why are you arguing with me? John Adams probably, I'll argue with you. After the nullification crisis, after we have the codification of states' rights becoming part of this slavery, this discussion of the expansion of slavery through the secession of the Union, we end up with how we left off in our last episode, which is the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Compromise of 1850. Compromise of 1850 is what brought California to the Union, and the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 brought the principle of popular sovereignty. Mm-hmm. This is something that becomes interesting. So the popular sovereignty movement was really framed as a states' right-like solution. So basically they said, like, hey, it's like having states' rights where states get to vote whether they're a slave state or not when they're admitted to the Union. In reality, it just turned into many civil wars over who would win the states.
Wasn't it just basically a bunch of people like shipping up their voters to all the states when they...
Yep. And who do you think had more money to ship people and send weapons?
Probably the North.
There's a North.
Probably the economically more stable side of things.
Yeah. So you had one place that was making money hand over fist, industrialization, that was sending people out there to settle land, and they were very morally convicted. And that's how you end up with John Brown's, where it's like, oh, wow, there's tons of money and weapons, and let's go have a little civil war.
Hey, let's go find Harper's Ferry.
Yeah, right. And as we transition out of that first phase, which is the expansion question, it's a secession, states' rights becomes this... Because it's no longer this idea of a neutral legal opinion. That's a term I saw a couple times. It's a political doctrine, and it has always been a political doctrine, and it'll always be a political doctrine because it has no stance in a federal system. It never had a stance in a federal system. It wasn't even a stance during the Articles of Confederation. I mean, because the federal government didn't go and try and fight the states when they weren't paying their taxes. The federal government was like, oh, this social contract doesn't work. We need a new one. Like, that's what happened. It wasn't like there was a big war that broke out. And what we have is we have the secessionists, their argument, and this is occurring by the late 1850s, where Southern leaders are claiming that states had the sovereign right to leave the Union if the federal government violated their rights, particularly regarding slavery. Here's a fun fact about the Constitution. There is no right to leave for any reason you want.
There's also no rights guaranteeing your right to own people.
I
don't think that's protected anywhere in there.
The Constitution explicitly says when slave trade ends. That's 1808. And this bleeds over into the secession of the secession of South Carolina in 1860. And it framed its – this is weird. So when it seceded, it framed its declaration explicitly in terms of states' rights to self-government and control over domestic institutions, meaning slavery.
Yep.
Just for the record, the Constitution and its federal system never claimed that states didn't have the right to self-govern. In fact, it very explicitly was like, hey, here's the 10th Amendment. You have the right to govern. And somebody's like, yeah, but I want slaves. It's like, no, federal. And
federal has ruled on that already. Anything else? You can rule on that.
But here's where it becomes interesting, Kyle. The 13th Amendment hadn't happened yet.
What was the 13th again?
That was what freed the slaves.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Oh my God, I feel like I should know that one. We talked about that.
Clip it.
I know, right?
What's interesting about this, Kyle, is the 13th Amendment hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
So there was never an explicit movement of we are going to abolish slavery. There was movements in the United States, and this is what becomes weird because the state rights supporters in the South act like they're reacting to something that's happening instead of no, they're not. They're the proactive party. The Northerners,
they reacted to Abraham Lincoln winning, maybe.
Yeah, but this is 1860.
Oh, okay.
He didn't until 1861.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting to me, and remember, no Republican had been elected before. Whigs were in power. In fact, they were winning pro-slave. There was slave owning presidents at this point. There were slaves at the White House, and they have this perpetual victim mentality of like, oh, they're going to take my slaves away. It's like, no, what was happening is you were losing economic ground because your system does not work economically in the long run. Right. It doesn't work. It is non-productive. The ability of specialization of labor, which we wouldn't really have Michael Kramer would obviously be over a century later discussing Ehring model, but we now know your system doesn't work. Low-skilled, uneducated labor that is oppressed and cannot choose what to do with the means of its production is not economically viable. Hello, communist Russia.
Like, right.
But at least they lasted 8 decades, not the Confederacy, which lasted 4 and had to print money on rice paper. Do you realize how bad your economy is when you can't print on the back of your money? Like, you don't have enough ink to print on the backside of your money? I have money from the Weimar Republic that exists between World War I and World War II in Germany, and it's nothing printed on the back because they didn't have time to print on the back and they didn't have the money to. I have money from just before World War I in Germany when, like, I have a $1,000 bill. That was, like, a year's salary. It's beautiful. It's ornate. But, like, I have Confederate money. It's not printed on the back. It's made of crappy paper. Like, you can tell a lot by a country by its money. Like, you were never legit. You're like, oh, I wonder why we immediately lost. And it's like, we made a little bit to the north. Like, you got as far as Gettysburg, dude. You got like 60 miles from the border. Like, what are you doing? We marched to your capital. It's like, oh, well, like, no, we lost. We were in Georgia. What do you mean you almost won? No, you didn't.
Sherman had a fun march.
Permanently altered the world from the from space with what damage was done. Like, but no crap, they lost. Like, it's so weird to me. It's like this figment, and that's why when it's even discussed in modern times, it's like a figment of people's imagination. I'm like, what are you? One side was like, oh, you are an agrarian based society that was non optimizing labor. And you were run by a bunch of people it was either like you didn't own slaves and you had no way to move up economically because all the land was owned by essentially all consolidated land that people were not being economically productive with. They were just doing the easiest thing so they could go play the violin by themselves in some weird, some weird giant house.
Definitely a Thomas Jefferson reference.
Exactly, Thomas Jefferson reference. And then you have people in the North who are like, how do I make this thing make things faster? And it's like, okay, so who's going to win this war? This guy who can manufacture rifles, or this other people who are living the way people were living in 1100? Like,
you know what would be neat? I think I'd like to electrify a factory to see if I can increase my production.
Right? Like, somebody's like, oh, I'll figure out steam engines and use them. Somebody's like, I don't want the steam engine because then I won't have the right to own people. It's like, why don't you just make the steam engine and free the people? Well, then I won't feel like I'm better than them. It's like, what? What? It's like, oh, I wonder why they immediately lost the war. It's like, not only do you have a population that is better fed, better educated, with better war material.
Also, like, is not afraid of half of their own population.
Yeah. Also, like, I'm sorry, moral high ground. Horrifically strong moral high ground. It's like, yeah, you're gonna lose.
And
it's
they're like fighting two fronts.
like what's going on? It's like, you had a ton of people and you could still run your farms, like, because you could send your men off to fight. And it's like, yeah, you had a population advantage, but like a population advantage doesn't really matter against technological superiority. And that's what happened. And what's interesting to me about the states' rights is that this idea of like self-government already existed. You already had the 10th Amendment. You just didn't like. And again, no law was passed. Abraham Lincoln didn't come into office and pass a law. They were proactive. They were on the offense. They were victims waiting to be offended. Like, that's how they viewed themselves. Like, it's like they wanted to be like, oh, they're trying to take away my slaves. When in reality, it was like, hey, your slaves, the reason your slaves are disappearing are economic reasons, is because it's inefficient to what's going on in the North. And all you need to do is wait for the economic benefit to start to get too high, and then slowly it's going to break. And listen, I hate to say it, but when something breaks, do you pick the old antiquated system, or do you pick the new system that's making you have the largest economy in the world? You're transitioning to having the largest economy in the world. No crap, you're going to pick the money and better economy over just, like, again, people wanting to learn cotillion. Like, it's bizarre to me.
Say we shouldn't bring manufacturing back?
I think we should. I mean, I still like it. Depends on what manufacturing. I think that's different than, like, plantations.
I know.
So, basically, President Lincoln gets in. He wins, right? He doesn't get elected until 1861, but the secession happened in 1860 from South Carolina. But all the Northern leaders clearly reject this interpretation, arguing the Union was perpetual. and you know, to this day, that's how I was arguing. Union is perpetual, and no state could unilaterally secede.
So let me ask you this question then. Any of the states that did secede, any of them doing it based off of a referendum? Like, was there a vote to do so, or was it just the leaders deciding, you know what, we're going to do this on our own?
I believe there were some states with referendums. Hold on, let me check something.
I at least have a little bit more respect for that, because at least the people are expressing their will, as opposed to state government trying to decide for the people what they think is best.
Yeah, so there were several states that had that did vote, that did have referendums to secede during the Civil War, though it wasn't... Okay, so Texas and Tennessee did hold popular votes, but the only people who were allowed to vote were effectively land owners, so it didn't really matter.
Yeah, not the people who were enslaved.
I do feel there was another famous vote that occurred during this time frame to secede, and that was the state of West Virginia seceded from Virginia to join the Union. That was a
vote. Dude, yeah. We need to cover that.
Yeah. It was sick. It was just like West Virginia's like, yeah, no. I do love that. To me, that's the biggest baller move of all time. Just right? Like, we're going to leave the Union. Like, you don't get a state. And it was funny because there's this whole idea of like, the Union took over some of the southern states, and a part of reconciliation and rebuilding and reconstruction, all the borders are going to go back to the same. And Virginia's like, we get that state back? And they're like, no. But you admitted that with us without our vote. Like, oh, because you were the... You tried to leave the Union. You mean that war you fought and the capital was in your state? Yeah, we just want the back. No, they're our own state now. And like WVU was formed in 1867, and there's something called the Morrell Land Act. It's why we have public colleges, and it gave each state federal land to sell to fund public colleges focused on agricultural, mechanical sciences, and all that stuff. And by the way, cool sub fact I learned about this recently is that the Morrell Land Act was actually reinvigorated in 1890, and that's why we have historic black colleges and universities. So really? It was redone again in 1890 to substitute. But in 1862, now West Virginia had fully become a state. So after the war ended, the federal government was like, hey, here you go, so go sell some land. And they formed WVU from that. They were like,
that's awesome.
Thanks. Like, appreciate it for doing that. By the way, talk about a blunder. If you're Virginia, Virginia was a huge state at this time. It connected you all the way up almost to Lake Erie. You had this huge landmass, and basically you were splitting the pro-Union that was, you know, Wisconsin and Ohio and Indiana and Illinois, those states. And even Missouri fought on the side of the, even though they were a slave state, fought on the side of the U.S. And you split them. And you also, like, so you had, like, all of, you could have attacked from the west and the south. And D.C.'s right there.
Right.
West Virginia's like, no. It also completely reduced their land border because they had this huge land border with Maryland and Pennsylvania. And Maryland was a slave state, but it fought on the side of the U.S. And you... They had this awesome, literally that's what it's shaped like. You know, that would be where the Northern Peninsula of West Virginia is. Here's, like, Pittsburgh. Here's, like, where I went to college in Morgantown.
Yeah.
Imagine just you lose your flank, and then you end up with a massive border of an enemy state.
Pops up right there overnight.
And you're like, oh, cool, let me go into that enemy state. And you go into the enemy state, and it's kind of cool if you read some of the journals of the West Virginia Volunteer Armies. The militiamen fighting the Virginians. So one of the first deaths of the Civil War is actually where my grandfather's from, Philippi, West Virginia. And it was like three farmers and a gray coat showed up and they were like, what are you doing? They're like, oh, we're a Confederacy. He's like, oh, cool. And they shot him. Oh, that sucks. It's like, you guys are murder. Why do you guys have a... If you go there, they have like a monument to it. I'm like, this sounds like a murder.
Sounds like a murder. Yeah, it sounds like a highwayman. Jesus.
And a lot of those soldiers that were fighting during that time period they write about fighting in Afghanistan. They write about fighting in West Virginia, and there's a interesting article I saw that they took a journal from Russians fighting in Afghanistan in the
80s. Yeah.
Wildly similar. Like, oh, really? It's just mountains. Because, like, these are a bunch of...
The Appalachians, like, the hill people. Yeah.
Bunch of mountains. And these militiamen knew how to hunt. They were using rifles, not muskets. And they were in these small things. And, like, there's a story of, the Confederates moving up a river. And I don't know how true this is, but there's a... I've heard the... I've heard the story a few times, like moving up a river. And I actually went to the area where this supposedly happened. And I don't know if this is just like a metaphor of all the stories put together, but they were moving up a river and they came to, it's near the Greenbrier, and it's near Greenbrier. And I went out there and I was at a camp and I was a camp counselor. And we took some of the kids out there to swim. And they talk about like this area. It looks like somebody carved it. Like it's beautiful. And what happened is that the militiamen waited for the Confederacy to kind of move their supplies down the river. And they started attacking them from above.
Yeah.
Knowing that the river bows back around. And there was no place to retreat.
Right.
And like it was like, oh, we just marched hundreds of miles through the woods thinking we're being stealthy. We apparently were followed the entire way. Now all our stuff's broken.
Ooh.
And again, modern maneuver warfare does not exist at this point. That must have been terrifying. Imagine just like, oh, everybody in these woods. Like, even you go there today, you can see, like, all the stars.
Right.
Because it's still pitch black. Could you imagine being a guy in the 1860s from Tennessee who's like, oh, no. Oh, no.
Where'd all our food go?
Where'd all our food? And if they broke everything. And but as we close out, like, on the states' rights angle and the states' rights discussion as we enter the Civil War, it is a political doctrine. It has always been a political argument. It is not this innate political discussion that comes within the confines of a federal style of government. Every state that seceded agreed to the Constitution, understood the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Nothing in the Constitution changed. There was not an amendment that made them go, I didn't originally agree to that. None of that happened. Everything was agreed upon. And they simply reached a point. As an economist, I'd argue economically, but there's a social argument. There's a moral argument. They reached a point where their system was no longer viable. And like an injured rabid raccoon, they had one option, and they chose a violent option. And they
chose to chew their foot off.
Right. And at the end of the day, it's what wins wars? Economies. Your economy wins the war. And the states' rights after the war has become this like, it was a part of Reconstruction? Was it part of national reconciliation? Yes, was it part of Reconstructionist. The argument of why states' rights was used does not end in 1861. It doesn't in 1865. It ends in, not ends, but it becomes also part of the narrative of, oh, removing that national blight from what caused the Civil War. And unfortunately, it's been latched upon as the reason, as opposed to the rationale for the reason, which was slavery.
Yeah. Whew. How you feeling?
Feel good. I'm very angry.
Did you get it all out?
No, not at all. Tiffany's asleep. I'm going to go wake her up.
All right. Any more thoughts on states' rights here? Anything?
It was about the Civil War. Is about slavery.
What is it about now? Do states' rights exist? Are they a thing?
No. I mean, there's been some recent Supreme Court cases that talk about federal jurisdiction and stuff like that. But no, that's still discussed at the federal level. There's still federal courts ruling now. And to this day, I mean, states' rights is a commentary among history buffs. It's not something that really exist.
All right, I think that's probably gonna do it for today's episode, so please join us next week when we return to our regularly scheduled programming. While you patiently wait for that, please jump into the comments, list as many individual rights as you can think of. Highest total will win a calendar. Email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com to collect your winnings. Push those thumbs up in the air, sub on your way out the door, visit the website to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.